I am absolutely elated to welcome today Dr. Shirley Raines to Culture Matters. Shirley is a friend, but she has an uncommon journey. She is an author, consultant, international speaker. She is the president emeritus of the University of Memphis. Shirley, I believe you were 10 years as the president of the University of Memphis. Is that correct?
12 years.
Wow. So your book is called An Uncommon Journey. And so I was reading, and my young daughter, who's 12, saw the book in my office, and she kind of took it from me. And she started reading it, and I didn't know she was reading it. And she told me yesterday, she said, "Oh, you're going to interview Dr. Raines. So when you're done with the interview, I want to meet her."
And oh, excellent.
When we're wrapped up here with the interview, Shirley, if you'll just give my daughter that honor, I know she'd be thrilled with that, because she did read your book and she loved it. So we're here to talk about culture and how culture impacts us. Now, you were raised, right, in Western Tennessee.
Yes.
And would you tell our listeners just a little bit about that background? Because it's fascinating just to see, and it is, it's an uncommon journey. It's one you would look at and you go, that's not going to happen. So tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I was raised for the first part of my life until seventh grade as a sharecropper's daughter, which means that my father farmed land owned by others, and we lived in a sharecropper's house. Wow. That was didn't have running water, didn't have an indoor toilet, didn't have a lot of things that people expect of modern society and society then. But then in seventh grade, my father was able to get money enough together to buy a farm, which was something that he took pride in all his life. It was a very small, humble farm, but we all worked it as a family. And eventually I, of course, did well in school because I had a mother who really was an excellent student and could have done so many things had she been born in another era.
Right.
But she was a farm worker, and then she worked in a factory, then she worked assisted in a legal office, and eventually had her own real estate agency. Actually, her journey was as uncommon as mine. But she was a very good student, and she wanted me to be a good student. And so I became a good student and was given a scholarship in high school. But my family had no idea what it meant to receive a scholarship. In fact, if you remember the story from my book, I came home and I said, "Dad, they're going to give me $300 to go to college, a $300 scholarship." And he said, "To do what?" And I said, "To go to college." And he said, "You can't take that money." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "You didn't earn it."
Oh, wow.
Receive anything meant that you earned the money, and he didn't see where I had worked to earn the money. He said, "You're going to work in the frozen food company where you worked every summer since you're 16. That's where we'll have another salary coming into the family." So my mother said, "Hold on.
Wow.
I'm going to go to the University of Tennessee, Martin, and I'm going to find out about college. And I'm going to find out about scholarships." And she came home and said, she said to my father, whose name was Athel, A-T-H-E-L. She said, "Sit down, Athel."
So she was a strong woman, even in those days, right?
She was a strong woman, but very few people told my father what to do.
Okay.
But she did. And she had my two brothers sit there and listen too. She said, "She's going to college, she's going to take this scholarship, and we'll see what happens from there." So that was the beginning of my college career. I became a preschool teacher, and from then I became a Head Start director dealing with children of the poor, and I recognized them because I'd been one of them.
Yes, of course.
And so from there, I grew into some other experiences, being a teacher educator, a department chair in a university, in three different universities, as a matter of fact. And then I became a dean. I became a dean at the University of Kentucky. From there, they asked me to become vice chancellor. And I said, no, I love being a dean. But they kept asking me, and I came back with a deal. I negotiated a deal. I said, I'll be dean in the morning and vice chancellor in the afternoon. If you give me another associate dean, you help me get the people I want. So I did two jobs. Now, only a woman would do two executive jobs simultaneously. And then eventually, after 6 years, I became president of the University of Memphis. And there are many stories.
It's amazing. So I want to pull back to those early years, that early culture that formed you, right?
Yes, right.
That most of us, none of us really at that age, have any say over, you know?
Right.
And so whether we're raised in the U.S. in the South, or we're raised in you know, Boston or Birmingham, or in the inner city of Chicago, or maybe Afghanistan, you know, that's not our choice, right? So what were some of, and if you look at culture and you kind of go, well, that's my beliefs and my values and my norms and my symbols and my language. What were some of the beliefs and values and norms that just shaped you as a young girl that would permit you to come out of actually picking cotton? Because I know that
yes,
you literally were picking cotton. And I mean, I was in ninth grade and took a trip to Kentucky and for a month to visit some cousins on my mom's side. I think, you know, my whole Puerto Rican hillbilly story. And so I was visiting some cousins on my mother's side, and they took me to pick tobacco.
Oh, yes.
In August. And I thought to myself, this is horrible.
Right. Yeah.
I am not doing this. What shaped you? What were the values that shaped you? Some of the beliefs that were part of your culture in that sharecropping environment?
Well, there are two different cultures. Certainly there is the culture of the poor, and we were poor. There is a saying that being poor is believing that you are less than what you are.
Mm.
I always add, unless there's somebody there to tell you differently.
Wow.
And my mother was the person who was there to tell me that it can be different. So even though she might be picking the same row of cotton I was, she was also saying there's a world out there where things are different than what you are experiencing. We also went to a tiny little church. And in that church, I learned responsibility of teaching classes. I sat in on the business meetings because everybody was a member of
everything. It was a little small country church.
Small country church, and everybody was a member of everything. So I had my mother to guide me. I had some of the beliefs from the church. But on the other hand, I saw people who live in the same poverty we did and worse, who went through, not everybody goes through this, let me make this clear, who went through early pregnancies,
sure,
married too young because they became pregnant. I saw incest. I saw people who were women who were beaten. I saw people who did things that had they had a little more, I don't think they would have done, but they were desperate. Frankly, we did have a secure family unit, which was very important.
Right.
My mother was the oldest of 11. My father was the oldest of 10. And because it was the youngest of 10, because my mother was the oldest of 10, whenever there were young children, and I was the oldest grandchild, she said, go take care of the children. So it was natural for me to have decided to become a teacher because of all those experiences of taking care of her brothers and sisters' children, her nieces and nephews. But there is a lot of dire poverty, but we were fortunate to have, we lived on a farm, so we had a garden.
We
raised cattle and pigs, so we had food to eat. And I had loving parents. They didn't always agree, but I had loving parents worked very hard and expected children to work as soon as they were able to move down a cotton row or to do anything in the garden.
How old were you when you first started picking cotton?
I really don't know. It's sort of like I can't remember exactly.
So it was young.
I don't know.
So I want to fast forward.
Yes.
And just encourage the listeners to fill in a lot of details of your life, because it's fascinating, by getting your book. But eventually you become the president of the University of Memphis.
Yes, an amazing feat.
What was it like for you as a female to come up and become a leader in what would most likely be a fairly male-dominated culture at that particular point? And not only what was it like, perhaps what lessons would you give other females who are aspiring to leadership and high levels of leadership that you say, hey, I learned this, and this really worked well for me?
Well, I think I was learning to be president of the University of Memphis from the time I was a Head Start director, because I think every leadership experience builds on the one before it. I was often the only woman. In fact, even at the University of Kentucky, I was the first woman dean of the College of Education.
Oh, wow.
So you can see that even in a women-dominated education field, they did not choose the women as leaders. So one, I had to learn to be a part of the group by knowing more, studying harder, being very prepared. If it was a meeting, I wanted to know the agenda, I wanted to know the issues, I wanted to get as much information as possible so that I could be a contributor.
Right.
Just the woman who happens to be there, but the woman who is the contributor. So I think the first lesson is that know what you're doing, find out what you're doing. You won't always know. There's several stories in my background, but my dissertation was about listening.
Mm.
I really believe that if we want to learn, we have to listen. So I ask lots of questions and listened a lot to people who were involved in whatever the endeavor was before I got to the regular meeting. So I think being a good listener, being overly prepared, determined to contribute, but not dominate. If you are a part of a group, you are to be a contributor. Now, the points at which you are to lead others in a group has the same qualities, but it means that you want to know what decisions need to be made in that meeting environment or with that professional group or whatever. Those are some of the key, some of the key lessons. And one is, when you make a mistake, admit it, get over it, and go on.
Okay.
Some women leaders and some men leaders, when they are leaders in their first examples of leadership at a major initiative, make mistakes. All of us do. Just admit it and say, look, we made a mistake here. We have to get over it and go on and deal with whatever it is that has come up.
What is your viewpoint of the Me Too movement as it's happened in the U.S.? Did you go through these types of things and harassment and kind of trying to keep you down? Because it takes different forms, right?
Right.
One may be a form of actually trying just to keep someone down. Another may be actual sexual harassment and this type of thing. What's your viewpoint of what has happened culturally in the last couple of years in the United States as it relates to female empowerment, the Me Too movement, relationships with men? I'm just curious as to your thoughts on this.
Well, certainly. In the environment I grew up in, I had to be strong. I was harassed. I did have attempted unwanted sexual advances. Most girls do, and if they don't, they're not telling the truth. And I was never raped, thank God. But I did have advances that were forceful and it was difficult for me to manage. And that happened. And I'm moving on in my professional career. I will tell you, it's not, I do not mention the place in the book, but I do mention being in a situation where I was the only female and being ridiculed for anything I contributed. Or, for instance, this person said, "Oh, isn't she cute today?
Oh, my."
You know, or, "Come and sit by me. This, you know, you look so sweet today." Things like that, that are condescending to the person, which says, "You don't really belong here. These men who are here do, but you really don't." Mm-hmm. I did that for 3 years and then I left. You have to decide in the environment, women have to decide in the environment they're in, whether they must stay or they must leave. And I made a professional decision that I must leave. It was before the time when HR was as robust as it is in dealing. And there's some things that men don't consider harassment that are really condescending, and eventually it pushes the person down.
Can you give some examples of that, Shirley?
Well, it is the same thing I experienced. It is ignoring, being condescending. It is when you're in a meeting and you make an excellent suggestion and nobody responds, and they come over to a male in the room and he makes the same suggestion, and the person in charge says, "Oh, what a good idea."
And you go,
"You already said that 10 minutes ago or 20 minutes ago."
Oh my.
And so there is, you know, there is that. And the not, as a woman leader, sometimes it was difficult for men to know how to respond to me. You know, in the South, we shake hands, but we also kiss each other on the cheek.
Right.
And that is a part of what we do. You know, I always shook hands, but if there was a person who was coming toward me, I looked to see if they were going to give me the little peck, because it was a socially accepted thing to do. And that was fine. I knew how to maneuver that. There are some women that would, you know, be
right,
stand off, but I knew the culture I was working in and knew what was acceptable and what was not. But I was offered my hand to both men and women. Many older women were surprised to have a woman offer her hand to them. So it's, there are different things. I'm rambling on.
No, it's fascinating. Do you feel in any way, and this is maybe a little bit deeper, Shirley, do you feel in any way bitter or in any way vindictive regarding some of those situations you had to endure as you were coming up through leadership?
Well, how should I say this? I don't feel vindictive now, and I have forgiven, and it took me a long time to forgive some things from my childhood, but in leadership positions, I did forgive and was able, or I left. As okay. Leaving is pretty...
That's like the ultimate.
That's an ultimate statement. I am happy the Me Too movement is happening, because I think it's getting out in the open what many women and girls have repressed for generations. So it is important. It is important for men to know how to respond in the new environment. And I think if you're a part of a large organization or even a small organization and you're the male leader, I think you say, "Look, I'm a little self-conscious here. I don't know how I should respond. Will you tell me if I am crossing any boundaries?" You know, I used to enjoy going to lunch with my male colleagues. Well, women now tell me that no male ever asked them to go to lunch.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it was a business lunch where both people pay. It was not a matter of somebody pay, who was going to pay. It was a matter of just colleagues going to lunch, or maybe taking a discussion that's happening in the meeting and saying, oh, it's lunchtime, let's take this to the cafeteria or to where their favorite place to eat.
I've heard some men say, in private, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm very leery now about hiring female leaders. You know, and this is just a conversation between you and I. I don't know how authentic they're being. And there may be some fear there. It's possible. How would you respond to those men? And I think it's a really, really important topic, right? I have two daughters, and I mentioned my younger daughter to you, and my oldest daughter is brilliant. She's an attorney, and we had some of these conversations, you know, and so if you were like educating, and you are an educator, right? If you were educating male leaders and you were giving them a speech and you were asked to say, these are the three things that I would say to you that I would encourage you to consider, what would those three things be?
It would be, please consider all of the women candidates and not eliminate them because they're women. Consider the women candidates. I am concerned about that happening as the blowback from the Me Too movement, that men are saying, well, I'll fix this. I won't have any sexual harassment I just want to hire the women. So hire the women. The other one I would say, if you're a leader, you have gotten there to the point that you are authentic. You're real. And so treat these women authentically as well. Treat them as equals. Treat them as human beings. Know when they're nervous, say, oh, I realize this is a nervous situation. It's nervous for me too in an interview situation because I'm trying to find the right person to fill my job. Give a word, I give a label to feelings. Go on and do all you can to get the best responses from the women whom you are interviewing or you've had join your ranks. Invite their participation. So advice is be yourself, but be your best self.
So
don't make any crude jokes. That's not your best self.
It's not the locker room, right?
It's not the locker room. Be yourself, be your best self. Give a label to emotions that are happening at the moment and find the right person.
So I know you're really got a lot to do and you got a lot on your plate, but if you're looking for another business opportunity, Shirley, you may consider writing a book or doing speeches for men on how to properly navigate today's world, right? Because that's a cultural movement and it's a very strong cultural movement. I want to ask you about another thing because you're from Western Tennessee and yes. You came up through a Southern kind of Bible Belt culture, right?
Right.
And became an academic in a major university. And how would you describe the relationship between, let's say, academics in the North and academics in the South culturally? Is there a mutual respect, or do you feel like maybe some of, for example, I just throw this out there, you know, maybe some of the Ivy League schools and things like that. Is there a different culture academically, a different way of viewing each other between the North and the South? Because in your profession, you've had to have a lot of interplay with people from some of these other schools. I'm just curious. It's a curiosity question as to what that has been like for you to culturally adapt, I guess, to that culture.
Well, I taught for 5 years in the summers at Harvard for new presidents and chancellors in a seminar that took place, a week-long seminar. And certainly I had people from all over the U.S.
Right.
Public school, community college, Harvard itself. So I have experienced that, and those of us who are from the South have certainly experienced it in professional organizations we experience sometimes a sense that you're from a public university and you're from the South. You couldn't possibly know as much as those of us who are at Harvard or Yale or Brown or whatever. And there is some of that. There is also a reverse discrimination of you couldn't possibly understand the issues that we are going through because you've only been to these elite places. Mm. That's not true anymore. There's enough mobility in academia. We had people who always recruited our philosophy doctoral students from the University of Memphis because we had more African-American doctoral students at the University of Memphis than anywhere else. So they were wanting our students. So it depends on whether there is a reciprocal kind of arrangement. And I think that being a part of professional organizations has eliminated most of that, but not all of it. You know this, don't you? You know this.
I don't know.
Wants somebody to look down on? Isn't that what it is? It's in cultures, it's in academic, it's the way the world operates. There's this sense of we're better than you are, but that's not the sense that we want. The sense
right.
that we're all in this together. It's this shared world. It's this shared academic life. And if you have learned a lot from a study in the deep South, and I learned a lot from the study of inner city Chicago, guess what we found? A lot of the same results.
Yes.
So, there's some commonality that can be gained, and then there are those differences.
It's fascinating. So here's my last question, just for now anyways.
I hope I answered the last
one. No, I think it's great. You're fascinating. And so when you became president, right?
Yes.
And now you're kind of given the keys to the, I don't want to say the keys to the kingdom, but you have a lot of influence and probably power, right? Yeah. And you walk in and you go, there are some things about this place I want to change.
Right.
Right? Which means I want to change the culture.
Right.
What were some of the things at the University of Memphis from a cultural standpoint that you really wanted to change? And secondly, what advice would you give to other leaders who kind of walk into an organization or an opportunity and they want to change things like now, right? And sometimes it kind of blows up in their face because they do it too quickly. So I'm just curious as to your experience, advice you may give along those lines. I think it'd be helpful for people.
Well, almost every leader is employed because he or she is expected to make changes. But in a large organization with 2,500 employees, if you walk in and say, here are the things I want to change about this place, you know you're going to get problems. So I said, I want to find out about what there is to do at the University of Memphis that you take pride in, that you think is working well, et cetera, and the things you don't think are working well. And I want to hear about those. And I did that by going all over the entire campus and asking those questions from the highest research office to the lowest physical plant office where the people were picking up the trash. I tried to ask those questions and listen to the answers, not go in with my set agenda, although there were some things I knew right away I wanted to change. There's a story in the book where I visited the campus during the interview process, and this was before the internet, and people didn't know who I was, so right. I went in and out of offices all over campus, and some were warm and inviting and helped me find. I pretended to be looking for the admissions office. Some led me there. Some never got off their phones. So, I told them about some of my experiences and that I was going to have some secret shoppers because
so you were,
gather information.
You were like the undercover boss before the show, huh?
Right. So, but once we decided on some changes that needed to be made, we talked about that with the campus. One of my administrators thought we should just send out a bulletin with all the changes we wanted to make. And I said, no, we're going to have face-to-face meetings with people We'll send out bulletins, we'll send out emails, we will do all of the things that are necessary to communicate, not once, but three or four or five times. And once we launch each new initiative, we're going to get feedback in that process. Because I think to sustain change, we have to know where the people are and also where we want them to go and not be devious about it. Say, we don't have enough African-American students given the population. Let's be sure we're changing and looking at the admissions process and creating a more welcoming environment. We are a metropolitan university. We should have lots of partnerships with people all over this community. So let's find the partnerships that are working and keep those. The ones that are in name only, stop them. Let's get building productive partnerships for this community as the base of what we want to do. So with each major thrust, we built on real information, we built on real feedback, and in that process, we all engaged, the whole leadership team, not just me. And so some good things happened in over 12 years.
So it sounds like you're highly collaborative and you're following your own dissertation of listening, which are great lessons for leaders, right? Because a lot of times leaders kind of like, this is my vision and this is what we're doing and I'm going to sell it. And they end up being salesmen of their vision, right? Or saleswomen of their visions. But you just said it, they've bought in.
Right. Yes.
Right? So you have all of that, the collaboration beforehand, before those decisions are made. And a lot of times what I've seen is that leaders will make decisions without not only getting the data, without actually having those collaborative relationships really solid, right? So right. I think that that's what, that what I'm hearing from you. So our time is up, unfortunately. I just would like to encourage the listeners to get your book. They can get it on Amazon, An Uncommon Journey, Dr. Shirley Raines. She's a fascinating, fascinating woman. It has been just an honor, Shirley, to learn from you. Your history, your trajectory, your growth is just, it's just amazing. And it's inspiring. So
thank you, Ricardo. Well, I likewise, you are the cultural mastery person. And certainly I brought some different dimensions to your thinking.
Well, that's the hope with these programs, right? Is that we would bring on guests like yourself who have high levels of impact and influence, but also high levels of intelligence, right? And where we can all learn together. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And maybe we'll have you back another time. I'd hope so.
I hope so too.
Thank you, Shirley.
You're welcome.
Thank you.